This episode of the Copy Blogger Podcast is brought to you by ConvertKit, the single best email marketing and audience building tool for creators. With ConvertKit, creators like you can easily share ideas, connect with your audience, and earn an income. Are you ready to start your next creative project for absolutely free? Check out ConvertKit now at copyblogger.com/ConvertKit. Hey everybody, welcome to the Copy Blogger Podcast. This is Daryl Vesterfeld and I am here again with Tim Stoddard. Tim, welcome back.
What's up, Daryl? Thanks.
So, updates. How's your week been? You were at the lake this week.
I was. I finally got out of town for a day. I haven't had a day off in I don't even know how long. So, me and some buddies went to Lake Cumberland and in Kentucky, and I spent the day on the boat and I did some wakeboarding, and it was a really, really great refresher. I gotta say, just being out there and relaxing and getting some sunburn. I feel really good right now, but as always, thrilled to be talking about Copy Blogger.
Same. So we just had our Q&A last week, which was really great. So thanks to everybody who came out to that. We love hosting these Q&As every once in a while and having people come in and just ask whatever questions they want to about content marketing. And it was a really great time. So thanks to everybody who did that. Mm-hmm. It was a good time. We also have an exciting announcement about a really huge piece of content that we've been working on for about 6 or 7 weeks. So you want to talk about that?
I would. And this is going to be something that the people listening can expect from us for the coming weeks, months, and years to come. We are spending a lot of time on our cornerstone pages. For the people that follow Copyblogger for years, you know the way that we like to structure websites. There's always a group of pages within a website that basically set the foundation for the rest of your site. And we call them cornerstone pages. And we have spent weeks, I'm telling you, weeks. Big shout out to Steven for helping put this piece of content together. And it is a monster long form guide all on content marketing. The reality is that content marketing looks differently today than it did 10 years ago. It was much more routine and common to have blogs and email. But now with there's so many different forms of media and there's so many different ways that people can create media easily, you know, obviously with smartphones and even with simple editing apps and podcasts, and it just makes it so that everyday folks like you and I can create content on lots of different platforms. And with these changes, we needed to update our content. We needed to update our cornerstone pages. And so we put together a huge long form guide all on content marketing. We are still writers. Copy Blogger is a community of writers, and I think that's always going to be the case. But it was important that we put together some of these resources for video, for audio. Definitely make sure we talk about email. We have some stuff about images in there, but not a whole lot because that's not necessarily where most of our listeners are going to be in terms of creating graphics. However, this is just the most robust form, the most robust piece of content that we've put together in a long time. So if you're interested in content marketing, if you're ready to get started, I highly recommend everybody check out this piece of content, copyblogger.com/content-marketing. It's got everything you need in there. So check it out.
And we'll see more of these type of pieces of content be published in the near future, right?
Oh yeah, for sure. I think we're going to do email marketing next. I believe after that, we're going to do one on podcasting just because that's so prevalent these days and people really love audio. And then we'll keep going with it. We got the next 6 months to a year to get all of these cornerstone pieces done, and they're so valuable. So I really recommend everybody check it out.
Awesome. So check that out again, copyblogger.com/content-marketing.
Yep.
And we'll also have that in the show notes so you can just click on that.
Sure.
All right, we've got a couple articles to talk about. Well, one article to talk about and then a new platform that's launched. Let's talk about the platform first.
Yeah.
Last week, Hey, a new email platform launched. It's from the guys who created, I guess, people. It's from the people who created Basecamp.
Yes, sir.
Really interesting tool. I have mixed emotions about it. I actually love email. I think I have my email is connected to Help Scout. All my personal accounts are connected into Help Scout, which if you're not sure what Help Scout is, it's a wonderful tool for customer success ticketing system. And I actually use it for my personal inboxes because I have 7 or 8 inboxes set up with hundreds of emails that come through every day. I love email. Email is super important to me. But Hey is this brand new platform that is super interesting. And I'm curious to know your thoughts about Hey and all that it means.
Well, I'm excited to learn a lot about it. They did a great job of just introducing the product and creating a lot of hype around it. I don't think any of us know exactly how it's going to translate into day-to-day life in terms of like practically managing your inbox. But the idea behind it, I think, is something that all of us can get around. It's basically a way to start fighting off the companies and the spammers that have taken email, that have taken something that is like so beautiful and such a big part of our lives and just ruined it with spam and unsolicited content. And it seems like a good tool that's just going to give us more control over our inbox. But like I said, I don't think a lot of us know much about it outside of that.
So basically some of the changes that they have in this particular setup with Hey is you can essentially redirect all of your inboxes into this Hey inbox.
Yeah.
And they say it all starts with a yes or a no, and they're calling it consent-based email. So basically, all of the emails, the first time they come into this inbox, you have to say either, yes, I want to hear from this person, or no, I don't want to hear from this person. If it's a yes, then it goes into one of three inboxes that we can talk about in a second. And if no, then you just never hear from them again.
You just never hear from them again.
Ever again, which is really interesting. So I love that term, consent-based email. It's really interesting. And then they call putting email in its place. And so this is what I was talking about. If it's a yes, it either goes into what they call the inbox. So I-M-B-O-X instead of inbox. Inbox. And this is for things that you need to read immediately. Then there's another thing called the feed. And this is for non-urgent emails like newsletters that you like to occasionally go to. Mm. And then it separates into a third one called the paper trail. And this is for things like receipts or things that you rarely need to read or go to. So, it's really interesting that they're breaking it down that way. They also have things like a reply later option where you can mark an email as read, set it to be replied later, and it will pop back up into your inbox later. So very interesting. I know these guys have really strong stances on data that's being tracked in email. And Nathan Berry and I had a really interesting conversation in a podcast episode just a couple months ago. We'll link to that so you can listen to it. About what that means for tracking things like open rates and click rates and things like that. They're also blocking a lot of that data with this new tool as well. So very interesting new tool. I know Brian Clark was tweeting about that he had tried it out, which I'm super curious. I'm probably not going to sign up for it because I don't want to funnel all of my email addresses into some different inbox, but it's a really curious thing. And I do think that these guys are going to shake up the email industry a little bit. And it might have implications on email marketing long-term.
Yeah, I do too. And let me take a quick detour on this because this is a conversation that I'm a little curious about. How do you feel about people being wary about their emails being tracked in terms of like open rates? Because I don't actually think it's a good thing to have people be really, really, I don't want to use the word private because I think privacy is important, but I think there's almost like this agreement where like, if you sign up for my email list, I'm putting in so much effort to deliver you this content. And like you opted into this for me. So like the least that you can do as a viewer, as a reader or a subscriber, is like, help me make it better. And I think opt-in rates or open rates and opt-in rates and things like click percentages, I think all that stuff is really important to have in order to make sure that the content you create is good. And also as a tool for me as a content creator to like make a living. And so I know that a lot of people that have this don't necessarily have this kind of opinion, but I personally am like really against that blanketing of data. I don't think it's cool and I don't think it's good.
So I agree with you. We are marketers. So I think we have a perspective of marketers.
That's true.
So I think the other perspective would say something along the lines of, I don't want you to know the exact date and time that I open your emails. That feels like a little too far. Mm. And a lot of email clients, I don't know if ConvertKit allows you to do that or not, but a lot of them, I know ActiveCampaign, for example, does, where I can go see, oh, you've opened this email 12 times and I can tell you the state that you opened it up in. and I can see the time that you opened it up. That feels, I think that's where some of the pushback starts happening is there are like not all data is created equally. I completely agree. Also, from a practical standpoint, people who are not opening emails need to be cut off of your email list every 6 months or so.
Yeah.
And that's important for deliverability. So I think that there's a big wide spectrum here, and Nathan had a really interesting opinions on it as well. So I don't care. I'm one of the people who I care about particular points of privacy, but I don't care that Amazon is stalking me on my different searches. I don't care that Facebook has specific data about me, because the data that they have generally helps improve my life, not make it worse.
Yeah.
And I'm not one of these conspiracy theorists that believes that the data is going to be used against me in certain ways. I don't have a lot to hide, so there's not much that I feel like I'm scared about people having. Obviously, I do have strong opinions about bank data and social security numbers and things of that level of privacy. So I do think this is such an interesting conversation, because one person can have opinion at, you know, level 47 of data, and somebody else could have one at 56, and there could be a huge gap between what data they care about being private or not. So I think the spectrum is wide. I think it's a very interesting conversation. I'm going to be curious to see what the implications are from tools like Hey, kind of forging the way around making data a little bit more private for their users, and what that will mean for email marketing and other things. So I think this is going to be an ongoing conversation that we had. Obviously, this is now the second time that we've brought something like this up just this year. So it will definitely be an ongoing conversation as we see of more things and learn of more things and get more data. We will definitely bring it up on our weekly show. But Hey is a really interesting tool. I'm really curious to see what these guys do. They've built really amazing products in the past.
Yeah, they're smart. And I know from the stuff I've used of theirs before, the product itself is going to be very easy to use. And I haven't used it, but you know, I think we can almost like promise that the user experience is going to be pretty seamless. So cool conversation, man. I'm looking forward to see where we go.
So next article is from the Washington Post, and the headline is "Record jump in retail sales sends stocks higher, but Fed chief warns economic recovery remains uncertain." So this is kind of about retail sales in general.
Yes.
But essentially, some of the numbers are that in May, while the unemployment rate was at a record high, 13.3% since the Great Depression, the retail sales numbers were up 17.7%. So really interesting. The reason I'm bringing this up is not because a lot of people listening to the show sell retail, but we do sell things like e-commerce, information products, services. And I have seen a corresponding trend in online course sales, in e-commerce. And my question to you, Tim, is this logically makes sense. A lot of Americans were given stimulus money. A lot of people were forced online in a way that they weren't previously. Mm. Do you think this indicates a blip in the radar or new buying behaviors for people online?
I think it indicates both. I think that May could be considered an anomaly because the circumstances were so, what's the word, like prone to have people sitting around not really sure what to do and just buying things online. However, I think that this trend, I think that what COVID did with retail, but more specifically e-commerce retail, because that's what you and I are really talking about in context to the show, I think it just accelerated it. If people were like kind of getting more and more comfortable with it, with buying things online, that month, these last 2 months have just put rocket fuel into it. And so now people are just, we're on board, you know, as Americans at least, and I'm sure in other countries, although I don't want to speak for cultures that I don't understand as well, I know that people are more and more comfortable buying everyday products online. And it's tough to say if that's a good thing or if it's a bad thing. Anytime I see stuff like that, the way my brain works is I always think of opportunity. If you want to sell products online, now is really the time to do it, because the way that I think you think as well, Daryl, is the times are going to change, and they're going to change no matter what. And not me, not you, not like a couple people combined are going to be able to stop these new cultural trends. So if people are buying products online, that's where you might as well be. If you want to be an entrepreneur and if you want to start a business and make some money. So I see that, and somebody that has a little bit more experience with physical products, I was very involved with like a streetwear fashion line. I see a ton of opportunity for people to double down on content marketing and on email to start selling jewelry or clothing or anything that you can actually create and hold in your hand. But you know, when it comes to e-commerce and physical products, we both know that like digital products goes hand in hand with that. So when I read that article, there's a lot of stuff there, and you know, we're talking about the economy and we're talking about retail in general, but clearly there's some implications just about the trends of our society and how willing we are to buy things online.
Yeah, I think there's a quote here in this article from Neil Sanders, who's the managing director of a company called Global Data Retail. And he says, "The disruption caused by the pandemic has done strange things to our perception of numbers." And I think that's really interesting. And I think I'm very curious to see how this continues to play out, because some of my clients have had record months in traffic, record months in sales, record months in new opt-ins. It's been crazy. And I think it makes sense logically, right? There have been, even though there's a record number of people without jobs, there have been stimulus checks and enhanced unemployment benefits, and many of those things offset some of those numbers. But we also are still not through this yet.
Yeah.
And as things are starting to open up, we're seeing different phases of states opening, cities opening, being delayed, being walked back. We don't know if a second wave is coming. We're still unsure. So there's still a lot of uncertainty here. And in May, 2.5 million jobs were added, but will that be a trend that continues? Will that slow down? Will that speed up? Will we get back to kind of a normalized state? And it's really interesting. But what I do know this for sure, that a lot of people who didn't shop online before are now more comfortable shopping online in a way that they weren't prior to the pandemic.
Well said.
And I think that's exactly what you're talking about. Yeah. So now is the time. It will continue to be the time. My parents ordered food from restaurants that they've never ordered food from online before in their life. They have done e-commerce sites that they haven't done before. They're more comfortable doing things online, buying things online in a way that they weren't before. So there's an entire category of people who are uncomfortable engaging online who are now more comfortable because the pandemic has forced them to shop retail, shop e-commerce, shop info products in a way that they weren't comfortable before. So I do think the market is now bigger, but that caveat is I also don't know what the economy is going to look like in 6 months. And So I think it's a wide ranging and we're still unsure, but really interesting thoughts nonetheless. And I think it's wide ranging. We're still going to figure out what the next few months look like.
Yeah. And I think a good way for people to put this in perspective is just reflect on what the last 3 months of your own life has looked like. I'm positive that people listening to this are listening to us read that article and probably thinking like, it couldn't have changed that much. But then if you just sit there and you think about things that you bought online that you haven't bought online before, it's clear that your behavior, at least my behavior, I'll speak for myself, has definitely shifted over these last 3 months. And I just think that there's no reason to assume that it's going to go backwards, right? Mm-hmm.
Last set I'll read here. It says, in all, consumers spent $485.5 billion in May on retail goods, groceries, and gas. And 17% of all those sales were purchased online. Super interesting. So that is way, way up. E-commerce is way up. Again, there's a lot here to be said, but I do think that the two things I know for sure is some behaviors and some demographics have changed. My buying behaviors are the same, but I was comfortable with online before, obviously. So some demographics have changed. There are new markets that didn't exist before, but we're still unsure what the economy is going to look like. So,
absolutely.
All right, let's take a quick break and we'll come back with our weekly question. This episode is brought to you by ConvertKit, an email marketing and audience building tool for creators. I love ConvertKit. Copyblogger loves ConvertKit. It is the tool that we use for our email marketing efforts. ConvertKit is a tool that will help you turn your side hustle into a career, help you find your niche, and help you inspire people through email marketing. It's a great tool. We love using it. With ConvertKit, you can easily share your ideas by creating landing pages to opt into your audience. You can connect with your people, even tools with automation that will help you earn an income. Are you ready to start your next creative project for free? Check out ConvertKit today at copyblogger.com/ConvertKit. All right, this week's question comes from Jim in Connecticut. Jim says, "Hey Tim, I was in your SEO masterclass in February. Thanks for all the great information. I work for a large law firm. I'm in charge of content marketing, and I've been writing content for a long time, but we're just starting to focus on SEO right now. How do I know what keywords to focus on so that I can drive traffic to my law firm?"
Thanks for the question, Jim. First off, thank you so much for attending the masterclass with us. There were a lot of people on that workshop, so maybe I was able to answer one of your questions directly. And if I was, I was glad to have spoken to you. And if not, feel free to reach out to me. You can email me at tim@copyblogger.com. I'd love to chat with you, get a little bit more detail specific. To answer the question directly, when it comes to SEO, and especially when it comes to service businesses, I'm going to repeat a lot of what I said in the workshop. Make sure you stay local. I've seen this a lot with lawyers, with other industries that are, what's the word, a little bit drier, you know, maybe like accountants. I've seen this behavior with before. These people that work in these businesses are very good writers, but they're very good at writing very informationally packed content. And so when it comes to writing content that appeals to a potential buyer a little bit more, I've definitely seen patterns where law firms struggle to kind of translate that content into a way that can be a little bit more easily digested. So my suggestions are twofold. One, go through all the content that you have already written and just make sure it's readable. If it's readable for people, then it's readable for Google. You really got to remember that. SEOs always make a bad habit of just trying to pack as many words as possible, thinking that they're appealing to a search engine when the search engine is the person. Google's smart. They know if the person likes the content, then they're going to like the content. The second suggestion is go through your service pages and make sure you localize them. You're never going to rank for something like personal injury law, but you will rank for something like personal injury lawyer in Connecticut. I don't know what city you live in Connecticut. What's the city in Connecticut?
Greenwich.
So you have an even better chance of ranking for something like personal injury lawyer in Greenwich, Connecticut. So go through your service pages. Most likely it's, you know, personal injury law, family law, corporate law. Those are usually what the service pages on law firms look like, and SEO them for the location. You're not going to speak to the whole country, but you don't need to speak to the whole country. You just need to find the people that need your services that are in your area. So great question, Jim. That suggestion, that tip is going to apply to a whole lot of people. So if you're listening to this and you know you have an accountant firm or you have a gym or you have something that appeals to your local market, that same advice applies. So thanks, Jim.
All right. I have some more questions here because I want to expand this conversation a little bit. I like the idea of local. I think that's been a revelation to me since I've met you.
Yeah.
Is focusing on local. I actually haven't even done this for my business yet, mostly because my business can't take on any more clients, which is a good problem to have. But focusing on local is super important. So I think that's a really great piece of advice. Here's my next question is, if I have, say in Jim's case, let's just pretend he has 100 blog posts, does he need to rewrite any of that content? Does he need to add new content? Does he need to look for keywords that are maybe not really thought of by his target market? What should he be doing other than focusing on local? How should he think about the content he has versus the content that he should be creating, focusing on specific keywords? And how would he find those keywords?
Well, thank you for that compliment, Daryl. And that is a really great extension to the question, because if there's two things that you and I have spoken about a lot when it comes to SEO, it's, yes, being as small as possible and going local, but it's also the idea that more content isn't always better content. Sometimes, and I've seen examples of websites that have 30 pages on them, and every one of those pages is written so well that they don't need to continue creating content. They have everything they need. So to answer the question directly, well, there's a few questions in there, but the first step is absolutely go back to your content. See if there's more opportunities there. See if there's pages where you kind of half-assed it a little bit, where you fell short on some of the word count, you fell short on some real vital information that you think somebody could use, and just make it better. I mean, I know that sounds like a very generic suggestion, but truly make it better. After you do that, if you want to get more technical and look for specific keywords, you are going to need a tool. You are going to need to purchase some software. So we recommend SEMrush, and we also recommend Ahrefs. We'll leave some of those links in the show notes to this podcast as well. But when you use those tools, you can see, you can search for keywords, you can see how much search volume certain keywords get, and then you can see how competitive that keyword is. So let's use the example of family law in Greenwich. If you were to put that keyword into the software, you would, like I said, see how much volume it gets and how competitive it is. And then you could use the data that those tools generate to help you write your blog post, help you write your service page. So it sounds a lot more technical than it actually is. Good SEO is a combination of common sense, and it's also answering the question. Because what I always say about Google is people go to Google to solve problems, right? So if within your content you can solve somebody's problem for them, then Google is going to reward your website with the hit, because that's Google's main objective, is to solve their problems. If you guys really, really want to get into this, that SEO masterclass, we put it in last week's newsletter, and a lot of people have already bought it and had great reviews. But I get into all of this in way more detail, and I go through actual examples, sharing my screen and walking you through these tools and walking you through how to do this research. So seriously, if SEO is something that you're interested in, I highly, highly recommend checking out the SEO masterclass on the copyblogger.com/education page.
All right, one more question.
Yeah.
So essentially, I'm going to be searching for keywords based on solving people's problems. I think that's right. And so I would use a tool like SEMrush or Ahrefs to find out if the questions I'm asking are relevant to people, and if people are searching for it, and if people are searching for it in my particular area. Or how would I use it? Dive in, just give us just a little taste, a little bit more. Like, how do I know specifically which questions people are searching for?
Well, that's a great question to ask. And one, there's two parts to that. One, the software will tell you. So it can be as easy as just brainstorming as many possible questions as possible, as many different keywords as possible. You know, my process is I put them all in a spreadsheet, and then I put them in the tool one by one. And then the next column, I put how many people search for that keyword. And then in the next column, I put how competitive that keyword is. And that's definitely a way to do it. But the other way to do it is take a step back from the data. Take a step back from all the technicalities behind it and just think of the user. If you're a lawyer and you practice family law, you've probably had dozens, if not hundreds, of conversations with people that have had problems with what your business provides. So take a step back from all that and just try to recall some of those conversations. Try to write down the questions that people ask. And this is a little bit more long tail, but people do go to Google and they just type random questions. I don't want to miss the mark here because I'm not a lawyer, but I guarantee you somebody has went to Google and said, how do I settle a corporate dispute with a family member, right? And that's a long tail search, and that's a little bit more specific, but people do solve specific problems, or people do look for resources for specific problems by searching their questions on Google. So like I said, twofold. Use the data, use the tools, map it all out, get a good plan together. But at the same time, don't rely on the data. Take a step back from it. Get more personal. Try to see what an actual person with emotions and problems in their life is gonna try to search for, and then put yourself in their position and create content around that.
Awesome. That's super practical. One last question, and then we'll be done for the week.
Then we're done.
How often should I be writing content, new content, adding it to my site? Because I know that it's important. Again, I'm an SEO hack. You're an SEO pro. I know it's important, or I believe it's important, to have content on my site being published on a consistent basis. So how often should I be writing new content, especially if I have maybe 100 old posts in Jim's, the example, we made up the 100 posts for Jim, but if I have 100 old posts, how often should I be adding to that pile of 100 posts? Because I think it's important to have consistent content being published.
I do too. And there's not really a right answer to this, to be frank. If you're the Huffington Post, they're going to tell you that they need like 20 new articles a day, right? If you're me on my blog who has to write all of these pieces myself and is very time consuming, I'm going to shoot for once a week. My suggestion with this is to create a publishing schedule and then stick to it. There are a lot of really successful websites out there that publish content once a month and they just take a long time in publishing their content. There's a lot of websites that publish content every day. My personal suggestion, because I think it's practical and I think it's doable and I think it gives the website like space to breathe, is to publish once a week. That is my favorite publishing schedule. It gives us time to write the content and to think about it. And it also, like I said, creates some consistency so people can expect your content to be published. And more importantly, they can look forward to it, because the part that we didn't talk about with SEO, and I'm not going to go down this rabbit hole, is that when you have a schedule, you can send that content out through email and then people know to expect it and they don't blacklist your emails and they don't unsubscribe because they're not used to seeing it for a while. Then all of a sudden it pops up. So my scheduling mechanism is once a week and then send it through email so that people continue to see you in their inbox and you won't lose your subscribers.
Awesome. Tim, that is really helpful. Jim, thank you so much for your question. If you want to ask a question that can be featured on the podcast, go to copyblogger.com/ask. Tim, thank you again for being so generous with your SEO wisdom. Check out the SEO masterclass. I was there to learn from you the entire time. It was super helpful. 5 days of recorded content from an SEO expert who literally drives millions of dollars of sales per year for the businesses that he works with through search. It's amazing. And I'm so grateful that we were able to do that. It's only $149. So check it out in the education tab on CopyBlogger. We'll also drop a link in the show notes on the webpage so you can do that. Tim, thanks for this week. We'll talk next week.
Thanks, man. See you next week, Darrell.